This webinar is put together to provide a solid foundation for folks and to help with the understanding of the law around HIV criminalization for all parties. So it's going to touch on some proposed modifications for the group to consider, including guiding principles to build out a statewide effort and to begin the conversation about how a decriminalization campaign might be structured and how it might look. For those of you that have not yet been involved in this process, you should know that there have been a core group of organizations and individuals that have been very active in trying to pull something together. And some of those folks are not able to join us today, but they'll certainly be informed of what we are able to cover today. We appreciate everybody's patience in allowing us to pull this together. It's taken a little bit of time, so it's really has been for the benefit of the whole group, including this expansion to a few significant other organizations that are on the call today. Real quickly, if you face any technical difficulties during the session, please feel free to contact Amira, my colleague here at the Williams Institute. Her number is 310-825-1198. I'll begin with the presentation on current California law and proposed modifications to the law. Like I said, my name is Ayako Miyashita. I'm the Brian Bell HIV Law and Policy Fellow at the Williams Institute. My presentation is going to be followed by Rashida Richardson, who's the staff attorney at the Center for HIV Law and Policy. Rashida will be addressing guiding principles for advocacy, including consideration about non-negotiable principles in legislation. Marco Castro Borges will be following Rashida. He's the community educator from Lambda Legal, and he's going to lead the last segment focused on planning a coordinated decriminalization campaign. We invite you to submit questions in writing using the Q&A tab on your screen. You should see it. I don't know if it's at the top of your screen or at the bottom of your screen, but it says Q&A. Questions can be submitted throughout the presentation. We'll do our best to address all of them, but if we don't get into any questions, if we don't get to any of the questions, we'll make note of the questions so we can address them later as a group in an in-person follow-up meeting or a future call. After each presentation, at certain points throughout the presentation, we'll be moderating a discussion using the questions you submitted, so feel free to submit them as we go. All right, I'm going to go ahead and get started. So for folks that are not familiar with HIV criminalization, I'm going to give you a brief introduction. So people living with HIV in the U.S. and throughout the world have been targeted by laws criminalizing sexual conduct. This phenomenon is often referred to broadly as HIV criminalization, and it's achieved by criminally prosecuting people living with HIV for possibly exposing others to HIV. Criminalization takes on different forms, and it can include criminal statutes that are specific to HIV, which often include additional or more severe criminal penalties and sentencing enhancements. And for jurisdictions like California with HIV-specific statutes, HIV is used as a factor in charging positive folks for crimes such as assault or assault with a deadly weapon, and you'll get to know these statutes real well in a minute. Penalties often include convictions for felonies. They can lead to longer sentences, and in some jurisdictions, thankfully not in California, but definitely in other states, they can be subject folks to convicted of these crimes to sex offender registries. So in the U.S., prosecutions for HIV exposure have occurred since the beginning of the epidemic, and certain jurisdictions have seen a recent rise in these prosecutions. With these high-profile cases, we've seen that individuals have been charged and are prosecuted for engaging in sexual activities that have a scientifically negligible and arguably non-existent risk of transmission. That's not always the case, but that is certainly the case in a significant portion that we've seen. Many advocates for people living with HIV critique the use of outdated science, the continued use of disproportionate penalties, and the particularly harsh impact of the laws on minority communities, including immigrants that are facing deportation, low-income individuals, and those engaging in sex work. So our focus today is on California. As I said in the beginning, we're going to go over the California statutes. We're going to look at the language and a little bit of the history. We're going to look at what a decriminalization effort might look like, what are the problems with the law, and what are some proposed modifications. And then my colleagues, Rashida and Marco, will follow up with what would be next steps. So in reviewing the published cases here in California, My colleague Amir and I have looked at what those published cases are, and the earliest criminal case addressing unprotected sexual activity involving an HIV-positive individual was in 1988, and it was a charge of attempted murder. And these general criminal statutes like attempted murder were used until 1991, and these cases were most often prosecuted under the Penal Code Section 245, which is assault with a deadly weapon. And in these cases, HIV was the deadly weapon. The first code I'm going to look at is the California Health and Safety Code 120290. This is the willful exposure of self to another to a contagious, infectious, or communicable disease. This is the general misdemeanor statute. It was enacted in 1939, and it's often been cited in civil proceedings, but there has been no published case involving this code section. Again, the punishment is a misdemeanor. HIV is carved out of that statute because it was established as a separate offense under California Health and Safety Code 120291, which says that unprotected sexual activity by someone who knows that they are infected with HIV, coupled with non-disclosure of status and a specific intent to infect the other person, is considered a felony, punishable by imprisonment in state prison for 3, 5, or 8 years. So in the traditional legal research that we conducted, even though it was enacted in 1998, there were no published criminal cases. And based on traditional legal research and other FOIA requests, there's an indication that there have been 2 convictions under this statute. The next code to consider is California Health and Safety Code 1621.5. This is the donation code section, that's how I refer to it, donation of blood, organs, tissue, semen, or breast milk. It was enacted also in 1988, and there are no published criminal cases found under this provision. This is also punishable by a felony, 2, 4, or 6 years. The next one is California Penal Code 647F, and just take note that if you want to do your own research, it is little f, not big F. We often make that mistake. Big F is public intoxication, I believe. So this specific code section is the sentence enhancement for people that have been previously convicted of solicitation and were tested and were found to be HIV positive. And so we often refer to this section as a solicitation while HIV positive statute. This was also enacted in 1988. There were 2 published criminal cases. Some of our additional research indicates that the large number of HIV criminalization cases in California are based on this code section. The punishment here is felony. The next section is Penal Code 120.22.85, and this is the specific sentence enhancement for violations while HIV positive for the sex offenses listed. So these are, under most conditions, they are the forcible sex offenses. And there are 4 published criminal cases. Again, it was enacted also in 1988, and it's a 3-year sentence enhancement that's added to the sentence provided for the specific violation, the specific violation listed above. Finally, there is the California Penal Code 120.22.8, which is a sentence enhancement for infliction of great bodily injury during commission or attempted commission of certain sex offenses. It's an additional punishment. So this was enacted in 2010, quite a bit later, operative in 2012, and it's a 5-year sentence enhancement. The reason why we talk about it here is because with the changes that we might consider, there's a possibility that folks could use this code section to create a specific enhancement, particularly for people that are living with HIV. So again, that somehow the exposure and or transmission of HIV would be considered the basis for a great bodily injury sentence enhancement. So if it's not already obvious to you, these are some of the reasons why we talk about why the law is problematic. The laws continue to affect people living with HIV because they are specifically targeted to people that are living with HIV. So we find that it contributes to HIV-related stigma. We find that it negatively impacts LGBT populations. We find that because a lot of the new infections are among gay MSM populations, that it's something to consider here. We find that these laws do not follow standard criminal law principles of requiring intent to harm. Now, there's the exception that the California statute, that is the HIV-specific exposure statute, does require intent, but all the other statutes having to do with HIV criminalization in California do not require intent. We find that the results in these cases are disproportionate penalties, that people living with HIV are more harshly impacted, harshly sentenced for their HIV status. We believe that the criminalization of people living with HIV and these criminal statutes defeat public health messages about HIV. So often we discuss in kind of the public health messaging about how we all as individuals need to take responsibility for our own health. But these cases often highlight what those of us in the movement and advocates have often said, the story or the messaging about an AIDS monster. So we find that it's problematic and counter to the public health messages about being responsible for your own health and being informed. Finally, we find that these laws, generally speaking, are unsupported by research. There is no research that really can prove that these laws on the books are act as some kind of deterrent and or are supporting public health efforts. So I have a question that's come up about patterns in the few cases where there have been prosecutions and what are the circumstances where these prosecutions come up. So the several cases that we know about so far, individuals that have been involved actually are not the cases where folks were charged under the HIV-specific exposure statute. They were individuals that were charged under separate statutes. So in one case, it was an issue about a sex offense with regard to someone who was HIV positive that ended up having a relationship with a minor. And so in that case, it was essentially criminalizing the sex offense and then, of course, tacking on to it the HIV penalty enhancement. I think that case was fairly early on and really represented the specific distaste, I think, of the prosecutor involved with regard to the fact that the defendant was HIV positive and was not being responsible. And so that's one example I can give. Another example is where actually the defendant was charged with another crime, part of the general criminal statute, and that person really, the HIV, that individual felt the HIV was a big part of the case, but you know, others involved in the case didn't feel like that was representative of the circumstance. So those are the two examples I can give of actual cases where we've talked to individuals. But I think that what this question really highlights for us is the fact that we don't know. We don't know the full story, and particularly we don't know the full story when it comes to individuals that are being criminalized for solicitation offenses while positive. And our concern is pretty significant in that the limited information we do know, those are the large number of cases of HIV criminalization here in California. So it's an area that we have to continue to look into, and certainly we'll update the group as we move along. So what would a decriminalization effort look like? You know, you should know that modification or decriminalization efforts have been going on in a national scope for a little while. There have been efforts in other states to amend, repeal, modernize HIV exposure statutes. And so based on those efforts, the Positive Justice Project has been trying to put out a set of model laws, like a model bill, essentially, that every state could use and consider when trying to look at their own specific state laws. And so based on that model law and based on some of the national efforts, we've looked at what would be some proposed modifications to California law. So, of course, when we're talking about modifications, there are a number of avenues we can take. We can maintain current law where it's appropriate. We can repeal laws and we can modify laws. And I think that maintaining current law is not what we wish, which is why we're looking at what would it mean to modify here in California. It would mean repealing and modifying. So what would be repealed? Here's a table, so this can remind you a little bit more about what we're looking at. So the idea is that for the statutes that are specifically targeting people living with HIV, that would be the first three listed on this table, Health and Safety Code 1621.5, 120291, and 647S, that these statutes would be repealed. And the idea is that, again, that there doesn't need to be a targeted HIV-specific statute because there are other statutes on the books that can criminalize the behaviors. The two that we look at modifying would be the general misdemeanor communicable disease statute under 120290, which would be modified to permit or allow or include HIV. And the second modification would be a modification to 120222.8, which is a sentence enhancement for the infliction of grave bodily injury. So what would a modification to the general misdemeanor infectious disease or communicable disease statute look like? And the idea is that any modification would look at an application of intentional transmission. So here there's a piece about intent, right, which is a concept and a principle that we've talked a lot about in this area, that it would have to be an intentional transmission. And it would look like this, that a person knows that they are affected by an infectious or communicable disease, that the person acts with specific intent, that they engage in conduct that poses a substantial risk of transmission to the other person, that the other person doesn't know about the person's infectious or communicable disease, and that the person has not undertaken any kind of means to prevent transmission, and that, in fact, all these things add up to the person causing the infection in the other person. A modification to the statute would include a carve-out, particularly protecting individuals that are pregnant while infected, or persons that continue their pregnancy while infected, or persons who decline treatment for an infectious or communicable disease during pregnancy. We want to make sure to protect those individuals that are soon to be mothers that are making decisions about their health so that they won't be criminalized under these statutes. So I received a question about the last slide. Let me go back, whether or not all of these conditions would be true, and about the intentional transmission of an infectious or communicable disease. And I think that the idea is yes, that you would want to build a statute that requires each and every one of these elements. And so if you take notice between the second to last and the last bullet, there is a semicolon and an and. So the devil's always in the details. We look at what are the definitions involved with a modified statute. And so the first terms we want to identify is what is an infectious or communicable disease that would fall under this statute. It would be non-airborne, that's something that can spread from person to person, and something that we determine to have a significant long-term consequence on the physical health or life activities of the person infected. So our idea is if you put general language in this way, it's easier to really make those evaluations moving forward, that you have more general language in the statute that helps to do that, but certainly have kind of the hard line limitations so that it doesn't get expanded to include non-airborne diseases. The next definition is the substantial risk of transmission. What does that mean in this kind of conversation about risk? And we have a lot of conversations about risk, a lot of times what we want to be able to do is kind of reel this conversation about risk back into what is based in science and what we know. So if there's any conversation about risk, we want to make sure that it's about a substantial risk of transmission. So what is the reasonable probability that the disease will be transmitted? Has this risk, so-called risk, been proven by competent medical or epidemiological evidence? And have we made sure to exclude conduct that poses a low or negligible risk of transmission? So making sure that that doesn't seep its way into the statute. The piece about practical means to prevent transmission. So here is the piece I think a lot of folks have talked about in terms of what is the role of treatment as prevention? What is the role of other medical advances such as PrEP, right? So we want to make sure that any statute that gets modified really takes some of these nuances into consideration. They're challenging to talk about because we're not all certain, we're not on the same page, but I think that most folks can get on board that there are certain means that can help to prevent transmission. So here's a definition that we might roll with. Any method, device, behavior, or activity demonstrated epidemiologically to measurably limit or reduce the risk of transmission. That's one. And we would define that by saying it includes, but it's not limited to, the use of a condom, barrier protection, prophylactic device, adherence to a medical treatment regimen for that disease as prescribed by a physician. So there again is the explicit reference to treatment. Finally, the modifications to the penal code that defines great bodily injury. So the idea is that if there's a possibility that there's a desire to use the sentence enhancement for great bodily injury, that any time that sentence enhancement is used with the specific context of a person or a defendant that is HIV positive, that we reference to the modified misdemeanor statute, which includes all the previous definitions that we discussed. And so this would essentially bring into the picture all of the considerations that we put into the misdemeanor statute, into this grave bodily injury equation, and that also we would require transmission in order for the penalty enhancement to apply. So a quick summary of what those modifications might look like. We certainly want to look at eliminating HIV-specific statutes that are no longer necessary, modify the existing misdemeanor statute to incorporate HIV as another one of the communicable diseases, and requiring consideration of knowledge, intent, conduct that poses a risk of transmission, prevention and transmission in the exposure statute, and finally closing a loophole in the great bodily injury statute. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and pass over the controls to Rashida Richardson.
Hi, everyone. So my section is going over some of the guiding principles for advocacy. And as Iyako mentioned earlier in the presentation, the Positive Justice Project has been working with a lot of advocates on modernization efforts in different states. And I'm the staff attorney that's in charge of coordinating the Positive Justice Project. So I've done a lot of work with advocacy groups in different states. And some of these principles are just lessons learned from work that's happening in all of the states right now. So the first point is that HIV criminalization is a multifaceted issue and has a broad range of stakeholders. So the advocacy coalition should aim to be diverse and inclusive. And what we mean by this is HIV encompasses a lot of issues in society: racism, sexism, HIV stigma. It's a disability issue. So we have to make sure that not only in the messaging, but in who's represented in the group represents a lot of these issues there. And the reason why this diversity of the coalition is important is because some key stakeholders may be effective messengers to certain legislators. So if a legislator is particularly interested or involved in faith communities, having faith communities represented in your group and maybe being the messengers to that specific legislator or other allies you're trying to engage in the work can be very effective. And the same in that some legislators will be sympathetic to different messaging. So some legislators may understand that women are disproportionately affected by HIV-specific prosecutions since they're more likely to know their status due to family planning and several other circumstances. So because of that, you want to make sure there are women-focused groups in your group so they can do the messaging for that, or at least can be the faces behind that messaging so they see that this is not just an issue designated to just one specific group that's affected. Sorry, it's not letting me move along. Okay. You also want to, in an effort, assess individual and organizational capacities early on, because a lot of this information will be helpful for determining an overall campaign structure, decision-making process, and leadership structure, as well as a communication strategy. And a lot of this will depend on how much any group is able to do, or any advocate. So that's knowing who may have certain resources, who may be able to go out and do some community education, and who is very invested in this issue, but they have a full-time job, so they're not able to put in as much time. And a lot of those different capacity and availability for capacity and ability to participate will inform what structure is best for your state group. And finally, state coalitions should stay connected to what's going on nationally, even though HIV specific laws and prosecutions is very much a state issue. What happens in one state can have detrimental effects on what's happening in other states. So if we were to move forward in California and pass laws with certain provisions that were not ideally what was overviewed by ACCO, then that can have detrimental effects on maybe what's happening in Tennessee, because legislators will see, well, this passed in California, so why are we going to concede to anything more than what they did, especially given the fact that California is a much more liberal state. So it's important for people to stay in tuned in what's happening elsewhere, and to also make sure that you're discussing non-negotiables early on within the group. And that's sort of why we wanted to have a presentation like this pretty early on, so that way everyone knows what's going on within the state, but is also agreeing that there are certain principles about a law or certain provisions that we're not willing to concede on. So later, when we do get further along in a legislative process, everyone understands that there certain compromises cannot be made, and understand why those compromises cannot be made. And so I'm going to go over what some of these non-negotiables can be. And a lot of them are very similar to what IACA went over in proposed changes for California's laws. And they're pretty consistent with what groups in other states are advocating for in their modernized legislation. So some of these legislative non-negotiables to be considered by the group is that a model law must be based on criminal intent to infect. So this is the same as what IACA went over, of there should be a specific intent to actually harm someone, and that should be required by law and something that the prosecutor has to prove in order to prosecute someone. It should be conduct likely to transmit. So one of the major problems that we see in California and nationally is that there's tons of spitting and biting cases, and it's common knowledge, especially amongst those who are well-versed in HIV-related issues, that spitting and biting cannot transmit HIV. However, those prosecutions do exist, and similarly, there's sexual conduct such as oral sex that people are prosecuted under, and there's really no likelihood of transmission. And then when you add on top of that whether someone used a condom or whether someone is on treatment, there's a lot of conduct that is commonly prosecuted. But if you're looking at the science and actually the likelihood of transmission in those instances, it should not be prosecuted or seen as a criminal act. The punishment should be proportionate to harm, and this kind of relates to the second big bullet point that I have here, that the penalties must be proportionate. So that we shouldn't have felony convictions, because there are a lot of collateral consequences associated with that. So what we would like people to consider is a misdemeanor. And that's something that can be more talked about within the group, but it's something that should be considered. So that way we're making sure that if there is a harm that actually was caused, that someone's not being punished excessively just because of their status or just because of bias of a certain prosecutor or jury. The next point is that there should be no new crimes or increased penalties for any diseases. So this goes back to the point of how we define what is being criminalized. So making sure that there diseases that can be passed through casual contact or airborne diseases are not included in these laws, because then it's just as much as we don't want a prosecution or even a law to be based on HIV, we don't want to expand it to the point that anything can be criminalized. And then the last point is the goes back to what I was just saying, which is the exclusion of airborne and casually transmitted diseases, is that when we move out of this HIV focus in these laws, we also want to make sure that we're not opening it up to allow too many or anything to be prosecuted. And with those points, these are all different non-negotiables or things that can be included in an ideal legislation that I think everyone should consider and should continue to think about after this presentation. And now I'm going to hand this over to Marco, who's going to discuss some of the roles in a legislative campaign.
Thanks, Rashida, and thank you, Ayako. Welcome everybody again to our webinar. I wanted to just start by saying that as a community educator here at Lambda Legal, I have the opportunity to travel in a lot of states in the West or the Western part of the U.S. And so specifically this topic of HIV criminalization is really important for me. So here at Lambda, we have consistently trying to repeal or reform HIV criminalization laws throughout the U.S. And as a community educator, I feel that I play a very important role I want to play an important role, since most of the time education and knowledge about the specifics of this issue are pretty much non-existent or they are diffuse or they are like foggy. And so I'm very interested at continuing working with a lot of people about around this issue. And so I'm going to talk briefly about the next steps and how. Oh, I figured that I need to move the slide. Let me see. Sorry, I'm trying to move the slide. Can somebody in the other side help me to move the slides, since I don't.
You know what, Marco, I'll go ahead and do that.
Okay, thanks. It's right there. So we certainly, as Ayako and Rashida talk, we have been working around this issue here in California. And so I wanted to really just make sure that you all know that all of these ideas that we have coming up are basically thoughts that have come from groups that have been meeting via phone and also in-person meetings here in Los Angeles and also in Oakland. So hopefully we can continue doing that. So to do that, there is an important need for us to find a core group of members of advocates in California to create that change. And as I can see in the participants list, we are from different sectors. And so it will be important to create a group that is diverse enough to actually represent the people that are most affected by this issue. We certainly wanted to include leaders and coordinators of the group, since it's a large state. We also have a lot of activity in Southern California and in Northern California. And certainly we wanted to empower the folks in the Central Valley to get involved as well. So I think that there will be a lot of opportunities for people to take leadership positions and also coordinating these efforts. We will also have to figure out how we're going to make decisions because we come from these different sectors and because we arrive at decisions in different ways. We certainly have to come together to make to determine what is it that is going to be our process. And I also feel that we have to learn from other states that they have gone through some of these processes as well. Identifying lobbies will be something important. So I'm imagining that we want to try to see which groups that have this special interest in this issue could be folks that can actually join us, that people that are supporters and advocates for this issue. And then we wanted to make sure that we also find a Sacramento-based or a California political consultant to help us throughout this process. We can see the next slide, Ayako. I want to talk about resources. And again, all of these is just ideas that I think could be enhanced by all of your participation and work. So certainly we're going to need money. We're going to have to draft the budget. We will have to have materials printed. And I also feel that we will have to do some work on social media and online. We don't know if we may have to have a leader that may require a salary. Political consultants are also expensive. And we also have to figure out who and how and basically who will apply for what funding. So all of those conversations will have to take place as we move along with this group. And then one of the things that I feel it's so important for this issue is that most of the time when I ask whomever in the street about HIV criminalization, they don't really know. They don't really know anything about it. And the media messages are constantly super negative. I don't think that what we hear from media, and I know that I'm preaching to the choir, is not really accurate. We don't get the right story or the whole story, as Ayako was saying. And so I think that would be very important for us to concentrate on basically trying to find somebody who can help us to do the right messaging. And as Ayako and Rashida was saying, based on scientific, principles or findings. So the next slide. We are now going to be talking about some of the activities that we can do. And some of these things have already happening or are happening. We certainly will have to have a calendar of meetings for us to have either on the phone statewide, but also meeting in regions in person. We recently had a meeting in person in Oakland and in Los Angeles. So we feel that those will be the two very tangible next steps that we can take on after this call. And I'm going to finish my presentation with that, but I wanted you to keep that in mind. We will have to establish roles and responsibilities. I'm assuming that there will be some different committees that need to be created, and we will have to continue talking and identifying the resources that we need for a successful plan. Then I feel that it's important for us to think strategically about this with political consultants. And so we will have to include different strategies and different leaders, identify them as, legislative processes is all about basically negotiating, right? In the meetings that we had in person in Oakland and Los Angeles, the group that has been actively working in this issue, we identify that education, advocacy, legislation, media, and communications and research are important aspects of this work that we're going to have to tap into it. I have some specifics for some of them if we move to the next slide. Under education, originally, this group was actually trying to put together a PowerPoint just to have basic education around this issue. So we certainly and there is people in this group and that have already done some work, including Lambda, around talking points focusing on public health or legal issues, due process, and also how this harms people living with HIV. I think that the education aspect is something really, really important since a lot has to do with the nuances of the issues. And so under advocacy, it will be very important for us to identify coalition partners that are going to be, primarily working on these issues. We need to organize allies and messengers. We certainly have to tap into folks at the public health sector in California, the juvenile justice or the justice sector. And because depending on how we move forward with this campaign, we will have to be very tactical and strategic on messaging to neutralize a position that sort of like anticipate arguments that we will have to be able to tap into it and respond properly and timely. The next will be on the legislation. Depending on how we're going to move forward, are we going to have a legislator that will be the author of a bill if we're going to write a bill, or the sponsors for the different bills, work with lobbyists, and also working, this is kind of funny, secure support from the Democratic leadership. I don't know how that's going to happen based on what we experienced a few days ago, but I think that we'll have to work a little bit harder than a couple of days ago. And then another aspect is under media and communications, just because most of the media messaging and clips and news clips are so negative, we have to probably tap into finding some collaborators in the media industry for us to have, editorial and folks that can actually balance, the conversation or the messaging out there. And certainly, drafting and doing research at a legislative level, which again, there is several of you in the call that actually are doing that work. So luckily we have a diverse group of folks that I feel if all of us come together, we have the opportunity to actually change hearts and minds and change, legislation or laws that affects people that are HIV or living with HIV, in a very negative way. So just to finalize my part of this presentation and pass it back to Ayako, the next slide is really important. I would love for all of you that are in this webinar today to join us in in-person meetings, both here in Southern California and up there in the north, Oakland or San Francisco, to really continue digging deep into these next steps that I have just providing you with an overview. And we certainly are going to have to schedule a statewide conference call after the in-person meetings. Again, there is a great momentum. There is great people doing this work. So I invite all of you to actually, after this webinar, I'm going to probably be sending a doodle for you all to see if you can join us in the next meetings. And I think that's all for me, Ayako, and Rashida. You guys can continue.
This is Rashida. I'm just going to add one other point. For most people, especially a lot of the new people who joined on for this webinar, we ask you to indicate if you wanted to be added on to our statewide email list. And for those that did indicate that, you were added. But for individuals that did not indicate that and are interested in joining the in-person meetings or participating in our statewide calls or at least just staying in the know, you can just send me an email at rrichardson@hivlawandpolicy.org. It was also at the beginning of the slide. So if you didn't receive any emails from us or don't receive an email shortly after this with doodle information, please let us know and I can get you added onto that list so you can stay in touch about what's going on.
Thanks, Rashida. Thanks, Marco. So if anybody is interested in getting a copy of this presentation, go ahead and send me an email or shoot me a message on this Q&A function. But for the purposes of today, we have covered the territory we wanted to cover, and we really look forward to setting up the in-person meetings in Southern California and Northern California and a statewide conference call. You should know that Marco with Land Illegal has generously offered to be the bridge between the two groups in Southern California and Northern California. He will be traveling to both sets of meetings. So thank you, Marco, and thank you to Landa for making that commitment. I hope this has given you some information and some basic understanding of the law behind HIV criminalization, particularly here in California. And we look forward to having you be a part of our efforts. Take care, everyone.